Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. As you might suspect, the Consumer Price Index numbers for July came out yesterday, and today is August the 12th. So we're going to be talking about inflation. The title of the article, and it's from Fortune magazine, is Jerome Powell's job just got a whole lot easier as inflation data sidesteps the disaster. It's by Eleanor Pringle. July's inflation report went about as well as the Fed and the White House could have possibly hoped for. The Consumer Price Index, the CPI, released Tuesday, reported inflation notched up 0.2% in July. That's compared to the 0.3% increase in June. Over the past 12 months, this brings the headline inflation rate to 2.7%. Admittedly, still comfortably ahead of Federal Reserve's 2% target, but the same level that it was in June. Shelter was the primary factor for the overall rise, the Bureau of Labor Statistics said, rising 0.2% in July. Meanwhile, key categories, such as the food index, were largely unchanged, with food at home falling 0.1% and food away from home rising 0.3%. Elsewhere, the energy index fell 1.1%, while gasoline costs were also reduced by 2.2%. Supporters of Trump 2.0 will use the relatively flat report as ammunition to urge the U.S. Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, to cut the base interest rate, arguing that tariffs are not yet providing as inflationary as many economists previously feared. Indeed, President Trump wrote on Truth Social moments after the data was released, "Jerome, too late, Powell must now lower the rate. Steve Mnuchin really gave me a beauty when he pushed this loser. The damage he's done by always being too late is incalculable. Fortunately, the economy is so good that we've blown through Powell and the complacent board." When the White House announced its tariff regime, particularly following its Liberation Day announcements in April, analysts and investors feared the significant added cost to global trade would be passed on to American consumers. Surveys indicate that this is the intention of the majority of business, to pass the increased levies onto the public, thus pushing up inflation. But with various agreements with key partners now made, and delays with the likes of China to boot, economists are now beginning to wonder when or if the sharpest end of the tariff agenda will be felt. The report is likely to have eased some of the friction members of the Federal Open Market Committee were readying themselves for. For many months, the FOMC has been warning it was mindful of the two sides of its mandate when making decisions about the base rate. Those two sides are maximizing employment and keeping inflation to 0.2%. With a shocking and negative update on the labor market from earlier this month, a spiking inflation report for July would have put those two factors at even greater odds. As it is, many analysts are seeing the inflation report as another tick in the box for a cut at the FOMC's next meeting in September. After all, they believe it means Powell and the FOMC can breathe easier about tariffs and give the economy and employment market a boost by lowering interest. At the opening bell, investors certainly seemed to think so. The S&P 500 was up 0.65%, and the Dow Jones was up 0.6%. The NASDAQ was up 0.76%. However, while headline inflation stayed below 3%, core inflation, excluding the often volatile food and energy categories, rose 3.1% over the past 12 months. Seema Shah, chief global strategist at Principal Asset Management, wrote in a note seen by Fortune that July inflation isn't hot enough to derail the Fed from cutting rates in September. There's some sign of tariff pass-through to consumer prices, but at this stage, it is not significant enough to ring alarm bells. But Shaw added that further cuts in 2025 are not a foregone conclusion. The concerns for the Fed is that with inventory rundown, the tariff-induced boost to inflation is likely to grow over the coming months, meaning that inflationary pressures are likely to pick up just when the Fed starts to resume rate cuts. Markets like today's inflation print as it means the Fed can lower rates unheeded next month. Rate cuts in October, December, and beyond may well be more complicated. While Powell has been fending off criticism from the White House, analysts are warning against baking in further and significant cuts for the remainder of the year. The FOMC have their next meeting in September, followed by two more in October and December, and one member, Michelle Bowman, has already confirmed that she would be open to such a trajectory. Indeed, UBS's Ulrich Hoffman Burcardi, CIO Americas and Global Head of Equities, wrote in a note to clients, "With overall inflation likely under control amid a slowing economy, our base case remains that the Fed will resume rate cuts at the September meeting and continue cutting for a total of 100 basis points. Indeed, CMA's FedWatch showed more than 94% of the market expect a cut at the next meeting. But analysts are wary to be overly confident beyond the next meeting. Elise Ausenbaugh, head of investment strategy at J.P. Morgan Wealth Management, wrote in a note to clients that while she was still expecting a 0.5% cut in rates by the end of the year, it still seems fair to say that the Fed could be considering a move in September. But I don't think a cut at that meeting is as much of a given as market pricing is implying. We'll get plenty of data between now and then that could give the Fed pause one more time before taking action in the fourth quarter." Michael Pierce, Deputy Chief U.S. Economist at Oxford Economics, wrote in a note to Fortune that the details of the CPI report don't even guarantee a September cut. The larger rise in core prices in July provides mixed evidence around the tariff boost to inflation. For the Federal Reserve, inflation is much further from its target than the unemployment rate, which is why we expect them to hold off rate cuts another few months. However, another weak set of jobs data in August would force their hands early, Pierce wrote. Core inflation edged up to 3% in July, and we expect it will rise further to a peak of 3.8% by the end of the year, as tariffs bleed through more fully to consumer prices. In our view, the upside risks to inflation will keep the majority of the FOMC preferring to sit on the sidelines for a few more months. The large downward revisions included in the July employment report heightened concerns around the labor market, and another weak report in August could tip the odds in favor of a September rate cut. Pierce was echoed by Bill Adams, chief economist for Comerica Bank, who said the Fed is now less likely to cut because the inflationary factors in the July report came from sticky service prices as opposed to tariff-related goods. Adams said jobs data scheduled for release in early September will have more sway over the Fed's next decision than this inflation report. Our next article is about a deal that President Trump negotiated with NVIDIA and AMD. And I must say, this deal is unique. It's from Fortune magazine and the Associated Press. It's dated August 11th. The title of the article is, "We Negotiated a Little Deal." Trump says NVIDIA and AMD will kick back 15% of China chip sales in a potentially unconstitutional arrangement. NVIDIA and AMD agreed to share 15% of their revenues from chip sales to China with the U.S. government, President Donald Trump confirmed at a press conference Monday. The Trump administration halted the sale of advanced computer chips to China in April over national security concerns, but NVIDIA and AMD revealed in June that Washington would allow them to resume sales of the H200 and MI308 chips, which are used in artificial intelligence development. The president said he originally wanted 20% of sales in exchange for NVIDIA obtaining export licenses to sell the obsolete H20 chip to China, but credit NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang for negotiating him down to 15%. So we negotiated a little deal. So he's selling an essentially old chip, Trump said. NVIDIA did not comment about the specific details of the agreement or its quid pro quo nature, but said they would adhere to the export rules laid out by the administration. We follow rules the U.S. government sets for our participation in worldwide markets. While we haven't shipped H20 to China for months, we hope export controls will let America compete in China and worldwide, NVIDIA wrote in a statement to the Associated Press. America cannot repeat 5G and lose telecommunication leadership. America's AI tech stack can be the world standard if we race. AMD did not immediately reply to a request for comment. The top Democrat on a House panel focusing on competition with China raised concerns over the reported agreement, calling it a dangerous misuse of export controls that undermines our national security. Representative Raja Krishnamurthy, the ranking member of the House Select Committee on China, said he would seek answers about the legal basis for this arrangement and demand full transparency from the administration. Our export control regime must be used on genuine security considerations, not creative taxation schemes disguised as national security policy, he said. Chip export controls are not bargaining chips, and they're not casino chips either. We shouldn't be gambling with our national security to raise revenue. Derek Scissors, senior fellow and China expert at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, questions the constitutionality of the deal. There's no precedent for this, probably because export taxes are unconstitutional, said Derek Scissors, senior fellow and China expert at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. They call it a fee, but 15% of sales revenue is about as standard a tax as it comes. For this reason, I don't think the arrangement is at all durable. If it were to last, it has two possible implications. First, there's a possible export tax that high-profile companies and goods must consider, or the tax only applies in exceptional situations, such as changing export controls. Then we'd risk national security for the sake of tax revenue, which is effectively the same as cutting the defense budget, Scissors says. Back in July, NVIDIA argued that the tight export controls around their chip sales would cost the company an extra $5.5 billion. They've argued that such limits hinder U.S. competition in a sector and one of the world's largest markets for technology, and have also warned that U.S. export controls could end up pushing other countries toward China's AI technology. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick told CNBC in July that the renewed sale of NVIDIA chips in China was linked to a trade agreement made between the two countries on rare earth magnets. Restriction of sales of advanced chips to China have been central to the AI race between the world's two largest economic powers. But such controls are also controversial. Proponents argue that these restrictions are necessary to slow China down enough to allow U.S. companies to keep their lead. Meanwhile, opponents say the export controls have loopholes and could still spur innovation. The emergence of China's DeepSeek AI chatbot in January particularly renewed concerns over how China might use advanced chips to help develop its own AI capabilities. Here's an article on Stephen Miron, whom you may not have heard of, but who you'll definitely be hearing about in the coming months. The title of the article is Trump to Replace Biden Fed Appointee with Stephen Miron, Chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. President Donald Trump said Thursday he'll nominate a top economic advisor to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors for 4 months, temporarily filling a vacancy while continuing his search for a longer-term appointment. Trump said he's named Stephen Miron the chair of the White House's Council of Economic Advisers, to fill a seat vacated by Governor Adriana Kugler, a Biden appointee who's stepping down on Friday. Myron, if appointed by the Senate, will serve until January 31st, 2026. The appointment is Trump's first opportunity to exert more control over the Fed, one of the few remaining independent federal agencies. Trump has relentlessly criticized the current chair, Jerome Powell, for keeping short-term interest rates unchanged, calling him a stubborn moron last week on social media. Myron has been a major defender of Trump's income tax cuts and tariff hikes, arguing that the combination will generate enough economic growth to reduce budget deficits. He's also played down the risk of Trump's tariffs generating higher inflation, a major source of concern for Powell. The choice of Myron may heighten concerns about political influence over the Fed, which has traditionally been insulated from day-to-day politics. Fed independence is generally seen as a key to ensuring that it can take difficult steps to combat inflation that politicians might be unwilling to take. Federal Reserve governors' votes on all the central bank's interest rate decisions, as well as its financial regulatory policies. Myron's nomination, if approved, would add a near-certain vote in support of lower interest rates. Kugler had echoed Powell's view that the Fed should keep rates unchanged and further evaluate the impact of tariffs on the economy before making any moves. Trump has said that he will appoint federal officials who will cut interest rates, which he says will reduce the borrowing costs of the federal government's huge $36 trillion debt pile. Trump also wants lower rates to boost moribund home sales, which have been held back partly by higher mortgage rates. Yet the Fed doesn't directly set long-term interest rates for things like homes and car purchases. At its most recent meeting last week, Fed officials kept their key rate unchanged at 4.3%, where it stood after three rate cuts last year. But two Fed governors, Christopher Waller and Michelle Bowman, dissented from that decision. Both were appointed by Trump in his first term. Still, even with Myron on the board, 12 Fed officials vote on interest rate policy, and many remain concerned that Trump's sweeping tariffs could push inflation higher in the coming months. Myron could be renominated to a longer term on the Fed once his initial appointment is concluded, or replaced by another nominee. Powell's term as chair ends in May 2026, yet Powell could remain on the Board of Governors until January 2028, even after he steps down as chair. That would deny, or at least delay, an opportunity for Trump to appoint an additional policymaker to the Fed's board. As a result, one option for Trump is to appoint Powell's eventual replacement as chair to replace Kugler once the remaining 4 months of her terms are completed. Leading candidates for that position include Kevin Warsh, a former Fed governor from 2006 to 2011, and frequent critic of Powell's chairmanship, and Kevin Hassett, another top Trump economic advisor. Another option for the White House next May would be to select Waller, who is already on the board, to replace Powell, and who's been widely mentioned as a candidate. Marco Casiraghi, senior economist and investment bank Evercore ISI, noted that the choice of Myron could be a positive sign for Waller because Trump did not take the opportunity to nominate someone likely to become chair once Powell steps down. After the July jobs report was released last Friday, Myron criticized the Fed chair for not cutting benchmark interest rates, saying that Trump had been proven correct on inflation during his first term and would be again. The president has pressured Powell to cut short-term interest rates under the belief that his tariffs will not fuel higher inflationary rates. What we're seeing now in real time is a repetition once again of this pattern where the president will end up having been proven right, Myron said on MSNBC, and the Fed will, with a lag and probably quite too late, eventually catch up to the president's view. Last year, Myron expressed support for some unconventional economic views in commentaries on the Fed and international economics. Last November, he proposed measures that would reduce the value of the dollar in order to boost exports, reduce imports, and cut the U.S. trade deficit, a top priority for Trump. He also suggested tariffs could push U.S. trading partners, such as the European Union and Japan, to accept a cheaper dollar as part of the Mar-a-Lago Accord, an echo of the Plaza Accord reached in the 1980s that lowered the dollar's value. As a fellow at the Conservative Manhattan Institute, Myron in March 2024 also proposed overhauling the Fed's governance, including by making it easier for a president to fire members of its board of governors. The Fed's current governance has facilitated groupthink that has led to significant monetary policy errors, Myron wrote in a paper with Dan Katz, now a top official at the Treasury Department. Here's something you might not have thought about with regard to the overall economic viability of a nation. This article is by Taco Engelar. It's from Fortune magazine, dated August 10th. The title of the article is Top Climate Tech Exec: The Air Conditioning Gap Between Europe and America is Becoming an Economic Liability. Picture this. It's a scorching summer day in the United States. You wake up in a cool, comfortable room after a solid night's sleep. You head to work, where the temperature is optimized for concentration. Unless you step outside for a lunchtime walk, you're completely protected from the heat. Now, picture the same scenario in an average European city. You wake up after a night of tossing and turning. You're sticky, uncomfortable, and already dreading the commute. Jammed on a crowded train, you suffer through a heavy delay as your city's transport infrastructure struggles in the face of extreme temperatures. If you're working from home, the only relief comes from a fan slowly circulating warm air around the room. The fundamental difference between these two realities, as an aside, that is a rather dramatic presentation of the difference. Okay, back to the article. The fundamental difference between these two realities, air conditioning. In the United States, 90% of households have AC. In Europe, just 20% on average. In some countries, such as the UK, that number falls to less than 5%. At first glance, this might seem like a minor difference, fodder for TikTok skits or Reddit debates, where Americans and Europeans poke fun at each other's respective abilities to handle summer weather. But when the temperature rises, the impact on productivity is anything but trivial. Europe's growing productivity gap with the United States, which has widened since the pandemic, isn't just a result of regulation, labor laws, or tech prowess. It's now also about climate, or, more precisely, the difference in how we experience extreme temperatures. Heat is an existential threat to some European economies. Europe is the fastest warming continent on Earth. Across the primarily AC-free nations, heat waves can, and increasingly do, shut down schools, disrupt businesses, and make it impossible for people to function at their best. Employers are forced to shift working hours to protect staff from the heat. Those with caring responsibilities struggle to look after the most vulnerable, children and the elderly, and families are caught in a daily battle for comfort and efficiency. This climate vulnerability isn't just inconvenient. It's a serious threat to economic competitiveness. Economists are already warning that Europe's failure to adopt a hotter future could dampen its growth prospects. Tourism, too, looks set to suffer as heat waves become more frequent, particularly in southern Europe. Holidaymakers are starting to look elsewhere in search of more comfortable climes. This presents an existential threat to the lifeblood of economies, particularly across the Mediterranean. As the continent struggles to balance the demands of climate change and economic growth, heat is a growing liability. Public calls for AC are getting louder. In the UK, searches for homes with air conditioning have soared, and AC is quickly becoming a middle-class status symbol. In France, politicians like Marine Le Pen have jumped on the bandwagon, announcing a grand plan for air conditioning. You might imagine that the solution is simple. Copy the US playbook and roll out air conditioning across Europe. Tempting as it may seem, it's not quite that straightforward. Air conditioning is electricity intensive, and most European nations don't have the grid infrastructure to support a shift of this scale. This fragility was laid bare in Italy this summer when a heat wave induced surge in demand for air conditioning triggered blackouts. Europe's national grids are straining at the seams, struggling to keep pace with a range of resilience upgrades required for modern consumption, and grappling with the volume of clean energy sources clamoring to connect. It's a deep irony that the vast quantities of solar power brought about by hotter, drier summers, which could unlock AC capabilities without creating a new carbon burden, can't be properly harnessed due to grid connection delays. Across large swaths of Europe, buildings are also older and poorly insulated. Planning restrictions are tighter, and the culture of renting rather than owning complicates installation. Collectively, beleaguered grids and logistical challenges mean those sweaty nights and lethargic days risk becoming part and parcel of European summers. To escape this incrementally hotter mind and unlock US-style levels of productivity that AC-enabled environments can bring, we need smarter infrastructure and more investment in it. That means using advanced modeling and AI to understand where grids are weakest, how demand is shifting, and where small targeted upgrades could unlock big gains. It means simulating future heat scenarios to stress test energy networks before a crisis hits or a capacity expansion is attempted. It means replacing guesswork with precision so that investments in cooling and the infrastructure behind it actually pay off. Only with this kind of intelligent planning can Europe move fast enough to adapt to a hotter future without burning out its grids, budgets, or climate goals in the process. Air conditioning may be the fix, but without addressing the underlying infrastructure challenges, Europe will continue to sweat through the heat and suffer the economic consequences. And across the pond, well, the Americans are just waking up from a great night's sleep. Here's a Tesla article. This one is a little different than anything you may be expecting. It's from Fortune magazine. It's by Sasha Rogelberg. Here's the title of the article. And yes, this is actually what the Air Force wants to do. Air Force bid for Tesla Cybertrucks in target practice symbolizes the evolving relationship between the Pentagon and big tech, expert says. The U.S. is taking steps to acquire Tesla Cybertrucks for the express purpose of blowing them up. But while the vehicles in this context are meant to be destroyed, the Air Force seeking out the Tesla brand is just another example of how big tech and the Department of Defense have become unlikely bedfellows, one defense spending expert said. The U.S. Air Force Material Command, part of the Department of Defense, is looking to acquire two Cybertrucks for target vehicle training flight test events, according to documents filed to the System for Award Management on Wednesday. The Air Force is also seeking out 31 other vehicles, including sedans and Bongo trucks, to similarly likely use as missile targets. Enemies may likely transition to using vehicles like Cybertrucks, which are more resistant to certain types of damages, according to the filings. Testing needs to mirror real-world situations, one document said. The intent of the training is to prep the units for operations by simulating scenarios as closely as possible to the real-world situation. Citing market research conducted in February by a redacted source, one document said Tesla Cybertrucks are specifically called for in this type of battleground testing because of its aggressive angular and futuristic design, paired with its unpainted stainless steel exoskeleton that differentiates it from other models. The vehicles do not need to be fully operational, but rather be intact and able to move on their wheels per the document. According to Gordon Adams, a professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University who researches defense spending, the Air Force's decision to purchase Tesla vehicles for battlefield training is, in isolation, of little consequence. But it is indicative of the growing ties between the U.S. military and private sector tech. At one point, I don't see it as terribly unusual for them to seek to use a Tesla truck as a target set, Abe Adams told Fortune. At another level, I find it symbolic of an evolving relationship between, in general, the high-tech sector and the Department of Defense. I have no doubt that this is something of the camel's nose under the tent with respect to the relationship between DOD and Tesla CEO Elon Musk and his businesses, of which there are many connections, he added. The Air Force and Tesla did not respond to Fortune's requests for comment. Indeed, the Air Force's interest in Cybertrucks is far from the first time the United States Department of Defense has taken an interest in one of Musk's projects. His companies have received billions of dollars in government contracts, including $22 billion in deals with SpaceX to provide launch services to the Pentagon, as well as for Starlink to provide satellite-based connectivity to the Defense Department in certain remote locations and support for military operations in Ukraine. The enmeshing of big tech in the Pentagon is unlikely to unravel anytime soon, as the ballooning demand from the military for innovative technology creates a whole new sector, Adams said. We're going full bore into the privatization of technology through the Defense Department using high-tech capabilities of companies like Apple and Microsoft, Palantir, and other contractors, including Elon Musk's operations. So it's a process which is now very much out of control. If you wanted to put the brakes on technology developments and take a close look at them under this political situation, the distribution of power between Republicans and Democrats, that's really not going to happen. The door is pretty open to the interpenetration of high tech and the Defense Department. We're going to do an article now on who is actually absorbing tariffs. There are many opinions on this. Here is yet another opinion. The article is by Eleanor Pringles from Fortune magazine, dated August 10th. Trump said foreign countries would eat tariffs, but U.S. consumers and businesses will actually pay 75% at best. When President Trump announced his tariff agenda, he said it would be foreign companies and consumers that would eat the price hike. That's a take that may prove optimistic at best and misguided at worst. While tariffs have yet to significantly shift the dial on inflation, prompting individuals like Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to label them the dog that didn't bark, analysts are widely expecting the hikes to be ultimately paid for by the United States. So far, the sharpest end of the tariff regime has yet to be felt. President Trump delayed his Liberation Day tariffs by 3 months in order to reach agreements with trading partners. Some negotiations have proved successful, with framework deals done with the UK, the EU, and Japan, to name a few, drastically lowering tariff rates from Trump's initial threats back in April. Yet countries that haven't yet agreed to a deal, which received letters informing them of their new tariff rate, saw their effective export rate rise on the deadline on August 7th. That includes nations like India, which is facing a rate of 25% that may double on August 27th as punishment for buying Russian oil. Likewise, while the Trump administration on many occasions has touted a deal nearly done with China, nothing beyond an agreement to delay tit-for-tat price increases until this week has been confirmed. With the slew of tariffs now effectively in place, Goldman Sachs believes that the cost absorbed by foreign exporters will grow over time, but will remain low. Economist Elsie Peng wrote in a note yesterday, seen by Fortune, that Goldman believes exporters absorbed 14% of the cost of all tariffs in June, which will rise to 25% by October if the sanctions follow a similar trajectory to the price hikes administered by the Trump administration in his first term. But the portion consumers expect to pay is also on the rise. Peng noted that around 36% of the 2025 tariff costs were passed on to consumer prices after 3 months of implementation, and around 67% were passed on after 4 months. The economist added that although pass-through rates appear to be increasing rapidly over time, it still remains below the pass-through rate that we estimate at the same point in time during the 2018-2019 trade war. One portion of the economy that intends to reduce its share is U.S. businesses. Conference Board released its U.S. CEO confidence report for the third quarter last week, which revealed 64% are sure that they would be passing the price hike on to consumers, and a further 16% said they're still considering. This is a higher rate than previously identified, following the prediction of Goldman Sachs, as only in June the New York Fed reported a smaller 45% of service firms were intending to pass on the full extent of their tariff-related increases. Peng noted that her math implies that U.S. businesses have absorbed more than half of the tariff costs so far, but that their share would fall to less than 10%. This net impact on U.S. businesses likely masks that some companies have absorbed a larger share of tariff costs, while some domestic producers, shielded from import competition, have raised their own prices and benefited. Of course, if consumers are paying higher prices for goods and services, then the Federal Reserve's job of keeping inflation to 2% will only get more difficult. Goldman Sachs believes this will be the case, writing, "Our analysis implies that tariff effects have boosted the core PCE price level by 0.2% so far. We expect another 0.16% impact in July, followed by an additional 0.5% from August through December. This would leave core PCE inflation at 3.2% year over year in December, assuming that the underlying inflation trend, net of tariff effects, is 2.4%. Reflecting on the June Consumer Price Index report, Macquarie's North American economist David Doyle and Chinera Azizova commented that the data was already showing hints of pass-through inflation. They wrote last month, "Notable price pressures were apparent in household furnishings and supplies, apparel, video and audio products, sporting goods, and toys. This list suggests impacts from tariffs on the data. One measure that reflects this is core goods, ex used cars and trucks. This accelerated to 0.3% month to month, its strongest pace since February 23rd. It also shows an accelerating monthly trend. Many economists are hoping Fed Chairman Jerome Powell will see through this inflation and lower the base rate, in part to offset an alarming jobs report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics a matter of weeks ago. But analysts can't hold their breath. After all, Powell made the point at his last press conference that by not raising rates, a move which truly would have upset markets, he's already seeing through such pressures." This is our last article on the Fed today, but I can assure you on future shows there will be many, many more articles on the Federal Reserve and its rate cut policy. Next, we're moving over to EVs, electric cars, electric vehicles. And as many of you probably already know, China is on the verge of dominating that market. So, what are American manufacturers doing? Here's an article on Ford's long-term EV strategy and the changes in it. It's from Fortune magazine and the Associated Press, dated August 10th, by Bruce Schreiner. Title of the article is Ford's new EV strategy includes nearly $2 billion in investment in Kentucky factory. Ford Motor Company will invest nearly $2 billion retooling a Kentucky factory to produce electric vehicles, which it says will be more affordable, more profitable to build, and will outcompete rival models. The automaker's top executive unveiled the new EV strategy Monday at Ford's Louisville assembly plant, which, after producing gas-powered vehicles for nearly 70 years, will be converted to manufacture electric vehicles. "We took a radical approach to solve a very hard challenge, create affordable vehicles that are breakthrough in every way that matters: design, technology, performance, space, and cost of ownership. And we do it with American workers," Ford CEO Jim Farley said in a release. The big Detroit automakers have continued to transition from internal combustion engines to EV technology, even as President Donald Trump's administration unwinds incentives for many automakers to go electric. Trump's massive tax and spending law targets EV incentives, including the imminent removal of a credit that saves buyers up to $7,500 on a new electric car. Yet Farley and other top executives in the auto industry say that electric vehicles are the future and there is no going back. The first EV to roll off the revamped Louisville assembly line will be a mid-size four-door electric pickup truck in 2027 for domestic and international markets, the company said Monday. The new electric trucks will be powered by lower-cost batteries made at Ford factories in Michigan. The Detroit automaker previously announced a $3 billion investment to build the battery factory. The automaker sees this as a Model T moment for its EV business, a reference to the mass-produced vehicle that launched the venerable automaker more than a century ago. But Ford says it's also a nod to the future and the vastly different way Ford says it will build electric vehicles. The company said it will use a universal platform and production system for its EVs, essentially the underpinning of a vehicle that can be applied across a wide range of models. The Louisville factory, one of two Ford assembly plants in Kentucky's largest city, will be revamped to cut production costs and make assembly time faster as it's prepared to churn out electric vehicles. "The result will be an affordable electrical vehicle that we expect to be profitable," Farley said in an interview with the Associated Press ahead of the announcement. "This is an example of us rejuvenating our U.S. plants with the most modern manufacturing techniques. The new platform enables a lineup of affordable vehicles to be produced at scale," Ford said. "It will reduce parts by 20% versus a typical vehicle, with 25% fewer fasteners, 40% fewer workstations dock-to-dock in the plant, and a 15% faster assembly time," Ford said. "The traditional assembly line will be transformed into an assembly tree at the Louisville plant," it said. "Instead of one long conveyor, three sub-assembly lines will operate simultaneously and then join together," it said. "Nobody wants to see another good college try by a Detroit automaker to make an affordable vehicle that ends up with idle plants, layoffs, and uncertainty," Farley said in his release. "So this has to be a good business. From day one, we knew there was no incremental path to success. We reinvented the moving assembly line." Other specifications for the midsize electric truck, including its reveal date, starting price, EPA estimated battery range, battery sizes, and charge times, will be announced later, the company said. Ford revealed its release that the truck will have a targeted starting price of about $30,000. Ford said its investment in the Louisville plant will secure 2,200 hourly jobs. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear said Monday that the automaker's plans for the Louisville plant will strengthen a more than century-old partnership between Ford and the Bluegrass State. This announcement not only represents one of the largest investments on record in our state, it also boosts Kentucky's position at the center of the EV-related innovation and solidifies Louisville Assembly Plant, and is an important part of Ford's future, Bashir said. Ford said its combined investment of about $5 billion at the Kentucky Assembly Plant and the Michigan Battery Plant is expected to create or secure nearly 4,000 direct jobs between the two plants, while strengthening the domestic supply chain with dozens of new U.S.-based suppliers. Ford previously forecast weaker earnings growth for this year and further losses in its electrical vehicle sales as it works to control costs. Model E, Ford's electric vehicle business, posted a full-year loss of $5.08 billion for 2024, as revenue fell 35% to $3.9 billion. Ford's new EV strategy comes as Chinese automakers are quickly expanding across the globe, offering relatively affordable electrical vehicles. "We're not in a race to build the most electric cars," Farley told the AP when asked about competition from China. "We're in a race to have a sustainable electric business that's profitable, that customers love. And this new vehicle built in Louisville, Kentucky, is going to be a much better solution to anything that anyone can buy from China," he added. Before going on to our next article, let's take a quick look at the size of China as an electric vehicle manufacturer. In 2024, China produced 12.4 million electric cars, which is about one quarter more than in 2023. This represents over 70% of the global electric car production for the year, according to the IEA. China also sold 11 million electrical vehicles in 2024, which is more than the entire global sales volume just 2 years earlier, according to the IEA. We're going to do an article from Fortune magazine next. It's by Jason Ma, dated August 12th. The title of the article is, "When the Next Recession Hits, Whoever is President Will Face Intense Pressure to Cut Tariffs, So Don't Rely on Them for Revenue," top economists say. The federal government is on pace to reap a significant amount of revenue from President Donald Trump's tariffs, but they may not be a reliable source of funding, especially in a recession, according to Moody's Analytics chief economist Mark Zandi. The average effective tariff rate is now 20.2%, the highest since 1911, according to Yale's Budget Lab. Based on the revenue tariffs are generating so far, they should bring in about $300 billion annually. Though that's not nearly enough to eliminate the federal budget deficit, which is expected to widen nearly $2 trillion this year, it's still a meaningful amount, so why not rely on them as a long-term revenue source? In an episode last Wednesday of Facing the Future podcast from the Concord Coalition, a nonpartisan group focused on reducing the national debt, Moody's Analytics chief economist Mark Zandi pointed out tariffs were imposed by executive order and can be changed in an instant. In addition, the so-called reciprocal tariffs are facing court challenges on the argument that they're not covered under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. As a result, Zandi cautioned against making other tax and spending decisions based on the assumptions that those tariffs will remain in place. And if the economy goes south, then all bets are off. I suspect that the next time the economy gets into recession, and it will, maybe not this go-round, but at some point it will, whoever's president is going to be under significant pressure to cut those tariffs, because they can do it under executive order. They don't need to go to Congress to get a piece of legislation, he added. A downturn may come even sooner than later. Earlier this month, Zani warned the economy is on the brink of a recession. On Sunday, he followed that up, saying while the U.S. isn't in a recession now, more than half of the roughly 400 industries tracked in government data are already shedding workers, a phenomenon that's accompanied previous downturns. Meanwhile, most of the cost of tariffs are being passed on to consumers, meaning that those import taxes are effectively sales taxes. Goldman Sachs calculated that around 67% of the tariff costs are being passed on to consumers. There's going to be a strong incentive on that president's part to say, okay, I'm going to cut the taxes, Zandi told the Concord Coalition's Carolyn Bordeaux and Robert Bixby. While Trump has floated the idea of using the tariff revenue to provide some kind of dividend or rebate to Americans, the White House insists consumers are not shouldering tariff costs and that foreign exports are. Either way, Zandi says he thinks it's highly unlikely that tariffs will generate $300 billion a year over the next decade, and warned against counting on a windfall like that. In fact, if you did that, we're just setting ourselves up for an even more dire, darker fiscal situation down the road, because I just don't think those tariffs are going to be around 10 years from now, he added. We're going to do a crypto article now. This is from Fortune by Billy Bambraugh. Title of the article is Trump just dropped a $12.2 trillion crypto price bombshell, sending Bitcoin, Ethereum, and XRP sharply higher. This article is dated August 11th. Bitcoin has seen its price rocket higher this year, topping an explosive 2024 that saw Wall Street change into crypto, though some are predicting the Bitcoin price bull run could be just getting started. The Bitcoin price has doubled since this time last year, with the crypto market looking eerily similar to the situation last summer that catapulted Bitcoin and other major cryptocurrencies, including Ethereum and XRP, higher. Now, as JP Morgan suddenly flips on what could be a Bitcoin price game changer, U.S. President Donald Trump has signed an executive order that will make it easier for Bitcoin, crypto, and other alternative assets like private equity and real estate to be included in 401k retirement accounts, which hold a combined $12.2 trillion. Trump signing the long-rumored order has boosted the Bitcoin price, pushing it toward $120,000 per Bitcoin for the first time last month, while Ethereum has surged 21% this week, breaking back above $4,000 per Ether for the first time since December last year. XRP, one of the best-performing major cryptocurrencies over the last year, with a near 500% gain, has climbed 12% this week, helping the combined crypto market to top $4 trillion. This could mark a major milestone in bringing digital assets into the mainstream of the financial infrastructure, opening the door to long-term adoption by everyday Americans, Anthony Agashkov, founder of Marvel Capital, said in emailed comments. The order gives the Department of Labor 180 days to review rules with any changes not expected to be seen immediately in Bitcoin and crypto markets. The Trump executive order opening the door to the inclusion of crypto and private assets in retirement plans opens the way to greater choice and gives investments more options, Caitlin Tischhauser, head of research at Signum Bank, said via email. It is another bullish driver for the crypto market, as the relatively small market capitalization mean fund flows can have a significant impact on price. In May, the Department of Labor scrapped guidance from 2022 that urged extreme care before any investment companies added crypto to retirement account options. The announcement has fueled optimism around future institutional inflows, especially given the size of the U.S. defined contribution market, which totals around $10 trillion, Joel Kruger, market strategist at LMAX Group, said in emailed comments. A more favorable regulatory tone is taking shape in Washington. The Trump executive order follows a series of signals from lawmakers, aimed at establishing clearer guardrails around digital asset classification and access. While there is currently no prohibition on retirement plan operators adding these types of investments, the order is expected to result in a more diverse range of options for people. This order isn't about the government saying crypto belongs in 401ks. It's about the government getting out of the way and letting people make their own decisions, Matt Haugen, Chief Investment Officer at Bitwise, said in an emailed note. Bitcoin and crypto market watchers remain bullish for the rest of 2025. However, some are warning the Bitcoin price and crypto market could crash next year. My view is that once we complete the bull cycle at circa 140 to 145,000 for Bitcoin, we'll see a corrective bear market in 2026. But I'm not looking for a deep correct, but likely a move to $90 to $100,000, John Glover, Chief Investment Officer at Ledin, said in emailed comments, adding, I know this goes against the popular view that we're going to hit the extreme prognosticators' views of 250,000, 500,000, or even a million in 2025 or 2026. Meanwhile, Trump also signed a separate executive order targeting the debanking of people and businesses on political grounds, which will ensure that federal regulators do not promote policies and practices that allow financial institutions to deny or restrict services based on political beliefs, religious beliefs, or lawful business activities, ensuring fair access to banking for all Americans. Folks, that's all we have time for today. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week at 11 a.m.